Welcome back to another unofficial guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. It is I, Len Testa, and this is our second podcast for January 2016. And I'm still writing 2015 on all of my electronic checks, but hopefully that'll end soon. And this being our second episode for January is a continuation of our History of Disneyland podcast. And to do that, I would like to bring in the man who came up with the phrase "running with the goats." It's one Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
They never proved that, Len.
Allegedly. I'm sorry, right. Aaron Adams, go back and let's add the word allegedly to that that podcast. I appreciate it. I would like to bring in the man who allegedly came up with the phrase "running with the goats." It's one Mr. Jim Hill. All right, so Jim, the running of the goats is actually this thing that they do at Disneyland in Big Thunder Ranch, right?
Yeah, and we're actually recording this on Monday, January 11th, so it's officially the day after Big Thunder has closed shop, so to speak. This was a recreation of an 1880s horse ranch that has to shut down because the 2 acres that it occupies is a key point for the 14-acre Star Wars land that's, you know, 2 and 3 years down the line.
Wow. So let's position this in the park for people. If you're walking from Frontierland to Fantasyland in Disneyland, the Rivers of America will be on your left. Mm-hmm. Then there's a Big Thunder barbecue place. And then the goats are right after that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually, for a tiny parcel of land, they cram a lot of stuff in there. There was an authentic reproduction of a log cabin. There was the petting zoo you're talking about with goats and sheep. There was a pasture for Disneyland's working horses, the horses that would take you, you know, up and down Main Street on the trolley. That's where they kept them. And this barbecue restaurant, which, kind of a funny story, the reason Disneyland got a barbecue restaurant added to it like this was because Michael Eisner really liked barbecue, and his wife Jane kept him on a very short leash, health-wise. And so, you know, it's just one of these things where it's like, could we have a barbecue, and could people not tell Jane about it? Because I would really like to be able to eat this stuff every so often. And especially after 1994, when Michael had his quintuple bypass, you know, that Jane pretty much caught on. It's like, yeah, Anybody who feeds my husband that crap dies. So, yeah, you know.
So that's how the barbecue restaurant ended up in an obscure part of
That's it, exactly.
That's awesome.
Know. Now, I know a lot of people are feeling bad for the goats, but to be honest, you know, Disney's been right out front mentioning that they've already arranged permanent homes for these goats at a farm in Murrieta. People are like, oh my God, a 30-year-old chunk of Disneyland is gone. And it's like, well, no. If you actually go back, I swear to God, Len, this is from the Los Angeles Times, June 23rd, 1986. Now, keep in mind, The Big Thunder Ranch isn't officially supposed to open to the public till 4 days later.
Okay.
And so here, you know, they're holding a press event, and it's touting this is the newest attraction at Disneyland, a live animal petting farm called Big Thunder Ranch. But here's Dick Nunes, the then president of Disney Attractions, telling reporters, now this is only temporary, and it will eventually be replaced by a glitzy-themed area.
And it will. It will, Jim. It will. The glitzy-themed area will be Star Wars.
Yeah. Let's circle back to Michael Eisner now. Here's the thing. Michael wanted, I mean, remember when Michael came through the door, he was very concerned about Disneyland wasn't all that attractive to teenagers, which is why you saw things like Star Tours Captain EO Videopolis put in the first 2 and 3 years he came through the door. Michael also, though, felt that there really wasn't a lot at the park for small kids, for the itty-bitties. And so the Imagineers, it was just one of these things where it's like, all right, let's look at this. If you take the aerial view of the park, and especially where Big Thunder Ranch is located, literally on the other side of the train tracks is the Circle D Corral, which is where all of the horses from Disneyland and the burros from the old mine train through Nature's Wonderland were kept. And so it's one of those things where it's like, well, wait a minute, there's a horse farm on the other side of the train tracks. All we'd really need to do is take this parcel of land, clear it, drop a pasture in, bring a couple of the horses over, and we've got something we could sort of build a petting zoo around. This was really done on the cheap. The 5 burros that were there for opening day had actually been captured in Death Valley. Disney had bought them from the Land Management Bureau.
Really?
Yeah.
The BLM?
Yeah. And for $75, if you really were fond of a burrow, Disney would arrange for you to be able to adopt it.
This beats the Wizard of Bras in terms of like strange souvenirs.
I thought you were going to go another way here with the Portland, you know, the bird sanctuary, you know, the joke there. It's the effect of, well, you know, the Bureau of Land Management can work things out with Disneyland. Why?
No, I did the Oregon thing, though.
Never mind. Okay. But again, continuing the recycling thing, the ranch house, for example, was actually built out of an authentic 1894 barn that Disney moved to the site and stripped for parts.
I had heard that, so they used reclaimed wood, and they were ahead of the curve on that one.
Yeah, and recycling over time became a really big part of both the Big Thunder Ranch and the Circle D. Just over the past 10 years, very proudly, they've become a zero-waste facility. And,
wow. You know,
of course, the irony now is that, boy, are they going to be a zero-waste facility because there's going to be nothing there.
Yeah.
Horses calved off-site, that sort of thing.
So the animals aren't going away from Disneyland, right? I mean, they're still going to need horses for the trolley and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Are they going to be on art coming in? Are they going to be on the bus coming in? Are they going to have a commute?
Yeah, so really want to see a horse with a bus pass. I have to transfer here, Wilbur. You know, they're building a brand new facility in the neighborhood, and everything will be trailered in. This is kind of a concern for the horse people, because it's one thing to have them backstage. For example, these are animals that really have to be carefully trained, because you think about the noise, the music.
Oh, yeah.
In fact,
just the guests alone walking, you know, 2 feet in front of them.
Yeah, and let alone the fact that every so often a giant steam train goes by, and that was what was great about the location at Circle D, that they'd get used to this noise. This is part of our world where, from the very first year this was open in 86, for the Christmas season, they swapped out the sheep and the goats for reindeer. And these poor reindeer, you know, brought into the park, and every time the train would come by, they'd stampede.
And oh, yeah. I mean, it's reindeer. They're in Southern California, first of all. I mean, and then there's a steam train going by every 10 minutes.
I'm hot. And what's with that whistling? The train was such a crucial part of what was going to be the next iteration of Big Thunder, which, remember, Dick Nunes, on 3 days before it opens, is saying, this isn't going to be here much longer, guys. And the reason it wasn't going to be there was that this was going to be this backmost part of the park, with its train track, mind you, was going to be the West Coast version of the Indiana Jones Epic Stunt Spectacular. Only the Disneyland version was supposed to take its inspiration from the opening sequence of 1989's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which, as you may recall, featured young Indiana Jones as a Boy Scout, who was played by the late River Phoenix, who's attempting to wrestle the cross of Cortez away from a bunch of Tomb Raiders. And what really captured the imagination of the Imagineers about this part of The Last Crusade was the sequence where young Indiana Jones trying to get away from these Tomb Raiders, and they suddenly come across the piece of the American Southwest is a circus train, and he climbs aboard, and he runs from car to car. And it was just one of these things where it's like, now, wait a minute. We have a part of Disneyland that's set in the American Southwest, and we have a steam train. We could actually do this as part of a show. And that's actually what they put into works. In fact, Gary Blumenstein, he was an Imagineer with the company from 1987 to 1992 as a show designer and writer. He recalled participating in story sessions with George Lucas for this project that were actually held up at Skywalker Ranch. And he wrote the overall scenario for the young Indiana Jones Spectacular and would have co-directed the live version of the show had production actually gone forward.
Wow. So why didn't it go forward with it?
This was supposed to be the very first project of size for the Disney decade, which was this huge, ambitious plan that Michael Eisner announced in January of 1990. And it just involved major attractions at Disneyland and Disney World and new parks. And I mean, it was this ambitious scenario that basically got derailed when Euro Disney went so far over budget and frankly frightened the company into sort of a, okay, let's be that much more cost effective. Let's be careful about this.
So we don't have an Indiana Jones stunt show in Disneyland because of the French.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
That's right. Enough. That's right. Sure. So let's get back to the Freedom Fries, folks. But
okay.
It was this dynamite idea. Where Big Thunder Ranch is right now and where the old Festival of Fools arena area was, picture this giant red and white canvas tent. And this was a huge venue, Len. Up to 5,000 people were going to be able to take in the show at any one time. And you enter to the midway area where you had all these streetmosphere performers sort of sell you on the idea you're going to go in, you're going to see this is a circus performance.
So far, the way you've described it, it's a mixture of storybook circus, Indiana Jones, and lights, motor, action.
Absolutely. The crowd takes its seat in the reviewing stands. And it had sort of a weird framing device. The show actually opened with the Indiana Jones that we know from the films. I mean, leather jacket, hat, the whole thing. And he's in this venue that he's visited in the past, and as Indy reminisces, suddenly it's 1912, and it's a more landlocked, not running across the desert version of the scenario that we saw from Last Crusade. And just like in the film, at one point, here comes the Disneyland train, and the cast proceeds to duke it out and run across the top of the train. It was really going to be a spectacular moment of the show.
And it was the actual Disneyland train?
Actual Disneyland train.
Wow.
Was going to be retrofitted with some circus elements to sort of...
Sure.
And of course, this train was going to have to run all day around the park because it wasn't a question of let's bring this into service for this show.
Right. It sounds technically more sophisticated than the one in Florida.
Very much so. In fact, this was going to be a play, as in it was a 30-minute long pretending that we're shooting a film or recreating moments from an Indiana Jones movie that we'd previously seen. This was one live continuous show. And it ended with the weirdest moment. Basically, what happened was young Indiana Jones had succeeded. And then in this very meta moment, who comes riding in on horseback but the old Indiana Jones, who then grabs the young Indiana Jones, who jumps on the back of the horse. And basically what they do is they ride up to the train track, which is on a berm that sort of brackets the back of the stage area. Mm-hmm. The horse rears up, they wave to the audience, and they ride off together, I guess, to meet Doc Brown and Marty with the...
Yeah, there's a time travel paradox there.
I've seen the concept art. It looked great. But again, it's a weird story moment. Anyway, sounds like a hell of a show.
Yep.
Well, from day one, as they began to walk it around the company, and this is perhaps where it went off the rails. Because remember, this was announced in January of 1990 and was supposed to be up and running for the summer of 91.
Okay. All right,
but,
sure.
But they go to the guys who were operating the train, and they're like, oh, wait a minute. So every time you present this, we have to stop running the trains around the park, and we have to hold a train somewhere off stage so it can make its entrance at the right time during the show. And then we have to wait till the show clears to start running the trains again. And it was just one of these things where it's like, from an operational point of view, that was going to be a huge pain.
Oh, yeah, because you'll have to get everybody off of the train half an hour before the show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, folks, last stop here, Main Street, USA. Everyone gets off, and then they have to position the train. But even then, it'd have to be a few minutes after the show actually ends before they could get the train moving again for safety reasons.
Yeah.
And if they're running, so that's probably like, an hour a day at least out of the train schedule. And if they're running five or six shows a day, that's 5 or 6 hours that the train isn't moving. You really couldn't do anything with that.
One of the reasons that Walt built this park was because he loved his trains, and he wanted them.
Yeah.
He wanted guests to have the opportunity to ride them whenever they could. Other issue is the entertainment staff was kind of like, wait a minute, how many people are you going to need for your streetmosphere?
Scores.
Yeah.
Scores. Yeah.
And it just wasn't going to work, or at least from a numbers point of view. So
it would probably be one of the most expensive shows Disney's ever put on with that many people.
And then let's not forget that on a totally separate development track, you had the Indiana Jones Adventure, the mine train ride chugging along. And eventually it was one of these things where the folks at Disney was like, well, look, we can present the show for 5,000 people 2, 3, 4 times a day. Whereas if we ran the Indiana Jones Adventure, 2,400 people an hour, and we can run that from 8 o'clock in the morning till midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it started to make more sense to go in that direction. Well, about this time, though, Lucas had spent so much time working on this that when Disney decided, we're not going to go forward with this young Indiana Jones idea, He had so fallen in love with the character that he actually decided, well, I'm going to do something with it, which is why he created for ABC the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which actually debuted on that network in March of 92. So basically 9 months after the stunt show failed to appear in Disneyland, it's on, you know, on a network that would soon be owned by the Walt Disney Company.
Wow. Oh, that's interesting. So that's where the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles comes from. That's neat.
Now, speaking of Disney circus elements, I think this would be a good time to break up Circus Fantasy, which was actually an event that was held in the park that predated Big Thunder by just a few months. It ran at Disneyland from January of 86 through March 9th of that year. Now, for those of you who know your Disneyland history, and actually we talked about this, Lynn, in the earlier part of the chronology series, that Disneyland did have a circus once. It had the Mickey Mouse Club Circus. The first holiday season the park was open. It ran for 6 weeks, November 24th, 55 through January 8th of 56. In fact, would have just passed the 60th anniversary of its closing, and it was a disaster, even with...
Yeah, I didn't see any buttons or commemorative pins on that.
You can go on YouTube right now and watch video of it, where they had full-size elephants with giant Mickey Mouse beanies parading through this tent and a magic ring Christmas tree. I mean, Walt spent big dough on this thing, and it played to half-empty houses. So here comes, you know, the new management team, and they're like, hey, we're going to do the circus-themed event. And
all the old-timers are like,
That's it, exactly.
The new guy in a circus. The new guy always wants a circus.
Yeah. But Eisner didn't make the mistake that Walt made, that it wasn't a circus in the traditional sense, as in tents at the back of the park that you had to march to, and it was a separate admission. They actually put the circus all over the parkland. They stretched a wire from the Emporium over to the Main Street Opera House, and that's what the tightrope walker went across. They performed over Disneyland Plaza.
So you saw it as soon as you went into the park?
Yep.
Makes sense.
But again, it's everywhere in the parkland. If you went to Frontierland, you could see a man shot out of a cannon who'd soar across the rivers of America and then land on a net on Tom Sawyer's Island.
You have no idea how much money I would pay to see that.
Wait, it gets better or worse depending on your... Like the Astro Sky Cycle, there was a guy who rode a motorcycle on this really thin wire to the top of the Matterhorn from the hub.
Really?
Yeah.
A motorcycle. Why did this go away again? Who do I need to contact?
This was deliberately created in the early 80s. And remember, the previous management team had always insisted during the slower times of year that Disneyland was closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. And Eisner had changed the park to a 7-day-a-week schedule. So they really had to create these events that made the Southern Californians come out to the park.
On a Monday and Tuesday, yeah.
When they hadn't come out before. So they did Circus Fantasy. They also did an event called Blast to the Past, which celebrated the 1950s. And they actually did a state fair, which was all about small town Americana. So they had like greased pigs and stuff like that.
I love these ideas.
Piling these temporary rides, like...
Oh, wait, I know. I just got this vision in my head as you and I are talking through this, that there's somebody in the Disney's Hollywood Studios back office right now just playing rewind and play over and over again with a pencil and a notepad, just saying, what did he say after the grease pigs? Typing furiously on the internet for motorcycle, wire.
I am so rider. If that is in fact the case, folks. But here's the thing. I mean, when at Disneyland, when you did things like take an old-fashioned Ferris wheel and you wrecked it in the middle of Disneyland Plaza for State Fair, this really rubbed people like Marty Sklar, who, remember, was an opening day Disneyland employee. In fact, his first job for the company was writing the Disneyland newspaper that Steve Martin, as a kid, used to sell out in front of.
I get the concern because, you know, Walt had wanted Disneyland to be not an amusement park.
Yep.
And then to put amusement park or circus elements into it is like the opposite of the thing that you're supposed to be doing. I kind of get that. On the other hand, they sound like moderately interesting ideas that would, you know, at least worth a shot.
Marty sort of held his tongue for a couple of years while this was going on. But finally, on the day he walked into the park, and here's the globe of death.
You know, is it the motorcycle thing?
This is the motorcycle thing.
That's probably a show element too far.
For those of you who don't know, what Glenn and I are talking about is it's a giant steel ball, all right? that two people on motorcycles ride inside of and don't hit one another.
Yeah, and it's an open globe, so you can see what's going on. And the idea is that they go so fast that they can actually go upside down. And the speed alone is the thing that's pressing them against the walls of the, or against the sides of the globe.
Okay, so picture this. The globe of death has been set up in front of Sleeping Beauty Castle for the 1987 version of Circus Fantasy. I mean, in the center. I mean, center of the hub. And for Marty, that was it. That was enough. So you know the Partnoy statue? The life-size bronze of Mickey and Walt? You know, everyone looks at that and thinks, oh, they put that there to honor Walt. And, you know, to honor his creative legacy. And then there's that whole mythology of, look, Walt's pointing down the street saying, look at all the happy people, Mickey. And
right, right.
That's a load, folks.
it's a wonderful story. And I emphasize the word story.
The reason that the Partnoy statue is there is if you put that there, you can't bring back the globe of death. So basically what Walt is saying is he pointed down the street, yeah, try to bring those carnival rides back in here. See what happens. But that's seriously, so that's what Marty did.
And, smart man, Marty Sklar.
Yeah. And if you go to the 1986 annual report, here's Michael Eisner literally boasting about these off-season events, how successful things like Circus Fantasy, and the lesson that Michael takes away from this is, you know, we don't always need new steel and concrete attractions, capital investment, to attract guests. What's really ironic about Michael saying this at this time in the history of the company is he's committed over $50 million for two new rides and attractions. Yeah. The Captain EO and Starters, which need plenty of steel and concrete. You know,
plus the Disney company, other than Walt, the Disney company's never had a bigger patron of the architectural arts than Michael Eisner.
There you go. But those two attractions, again, Captain EO opens summer of 86, Star Tours opens January of 87. They're enormously popular, hugely successful, so much so that by the late 1980s, 30% of all Disneyland guests are spending a significant amount of their time in that theme park in Tomorrowland. We're talking 30% of the guests. Whereas Critter Country, even with the two brand new Country Bear shows, the Christmas special, Vacation Hoedown, only 2% of the guests are spending significant time in the backwoods section.
Wow.
Something had to be done. I mean, the park guest traffic patterns were so out of whack at this point.
All right.
That was the pressure. We got to figure out how to spread these people out more, because it's like Tomorrowland was just taking this huge hit from maintenance and staffing, and there wasn't enough food service to handle all the people on that side of the park. And just what it was doing for guest flow when the moments when the line for Star Tours was so long, it would stretch down Main Street.
Sure. Having 30% of the guests in any one area is just a recipe for disaster. But having 30% of them in one area and 2% of them in another is even worse.
There were the huge cost overruns that occurred on the production and construction of Captain EO and Star Tours. And so Eisner was really, really sensitive about, at this point, the next thing out the door has to be more economical. And that's actually kind of what led to Splash Mountain, because it was kind of like, well, we'll recycle the American Sings AA figures so we don't have to buy those. And we've got this company in New Hampshire that does Flume ride vehicles, and we can buy an off-the-shelf ride system. And it was going to be the affordable solution to balancing out the park. And as you'll discover in our next episode of the Chronological Disneyland, they could not have been more wrong.
I think we've alluded to this before in the history that we've talked about how it's ended up going way over budget and taking way more time. But the actual ins and outs of it would be interesting.
Yep, that's our next one, folks. So come on back and we'll give you the skinny on Splash.
Jim, so real quick before we go, we talked about this before we started recording, but Disney's filed a flight plan, a notice of flight plan approval with the FAA for some drones in Disneyland and Walt Disney World. And I think, so I want to get your take on that, but also not only on the drones, but on the specific parks and patterns that they illustrated in the approval process. I believe there was one in Epcot.
Yeah. And if you look at the way they decided to at least make use of this technology, or at least the way they're demonstrating it for Epcot is to, and remember, they're filing these forms with the FAA to try to get a variance to actually use this technology at Walt Disney World. Because right now, there's this huge brouhaha about whether drones should be like actual physical airplanes, be licensed and numbers and that level of control.
There is some concern there, right? So over the holidays, did you see the film of the huge television camera drone that crashed just behind one of the alpine skiers it was filming?
Ooh, no, missed that one.
So these, yeah, everybody thinks these drones are like the size of a size of your hand, mm-hmm. or maybe the size of a small a dinner plate or something like that. But mm-hmm. the ones that hover above sporting events mm-hmm. are more like the size of a dishwasher. And they're huge. I mean, in terms of size, not in terms of volume or weight. But there was, I guess it was ABC that was filming an alpine skiing event. And one of the drones had become uncommunicative with its operator. And the way that the drone is programmed is it goes directly to the ground as soon as that happens. So it doesn't, you know, fly off into an airplane or anything. Unfortunately, it was directly over the alpine skiing course when this happened, and it crashed maybe 5 feet behind a skier who was on the course and racing at the time. Oh. And you know, had it been another second earlier, it would have been disaster. And I think that's the thing that the FAA is concerned about with these things, that you know, worst case scenario, if one of these drones has to come down, it's not going to come down over people. And so I think the thing that you see with the Disney flight plan mm-hmm. over Epcot is that it stays pretty much above buildings.
Yes. In fact, when you look at the filing, is they show, at least for the application, that these drones will come off of the roof of the Odyssey restaurant.
Yes.
And then proceed to, you folks are probably familiar with the waterway we're talking about. It's that as you're coming from Future World headed to World Showcase, there's a waterway to your left. Typically, you'll know it from Flower and Garden where they float planters out on it. But they showed a flight path that went strictly to the middle of this body of water and stressed the fact in the filing that never above the guests, and that there's a safety buffer zone in all directions to the effect of this is as close as we will get to the guests. So, yes, I mean, Disney already has in its mind, much like what you just described with the ABC Sports drone, that the effect of if something goes south with this show, the drone, rather than being over a crowd, just drops straight into the water and they'll just recover it at the end of the show.
Yeah.
Or after the guests have left the park. You and I have talked previously about Disney wanting to use these in a show, and they wanted to use them in World Showcase Lagoon, but they kept getting pushback from Disney's lawyers about, well, how can we do this and safely transition these to the performance space over the guests?
Did I almost have to boat them out ahead of time?
I believe so. The problem for me is that you need a facility that these things can return to safely. So it basically means creating some sort of a barge that they could use as their base of operations, or at least if they're going to do World Showcase. We'd also heard that this was going to be part of the 50th anniversary or redo of the electrical water pageant over in Seven Seas Lagoon.
And they've got a lot more space there, right?
Yeah, but we're seeing they're in the middle of the approval process, and they clearly have a place at Epcot that they at least want to try this at.
Yep.
I don't honestly see that as a full-time performance venue, at least what they've shown on the application, because that's a space that could maybe hold how many people? 4,000, if that?
They'd have to be using it for some sort of pre-show thing. That or the drone would go up, you know, relatively high, because you've got a number of things blocking mm-hmm. that particular view, not the least of which is the Mexico Pyramid, which is going to block everything to the left of the American Adventure. If you're standing in Future World, you wouldn't be able to see anything that drone's doing.
And the other thing, I guess, that concerns me about the show in general is that there was a restriction placed on, if the wind was above 10 miles an hour, they couldn't do the show. I mean, they're basically...
Yeah, and in Florida, that's, you know, half the days of the year.
Yeah, so...
Although, you know, the winds typically do die down at night. But that leads to another question. Mm-hmm. So I know that Epcot has had a show replacement for Illuminations done for more than a year.
Yep.
but they haven't put it into place. Is this another indication that something's coming this year?
To me, it is a big honking indication that they're anxious to walk this thing out. I mean, remember that between Frozen Ever After, coupled with Soaring, I mean, we were talking earlier about what sort of impact is this in fact going to have attendance at that park. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that will certainly help. But if you had a new nighttime show coming in, that's a 1-2-3 punch that would definitely...
Yeah, people would stay all day.
Yeah, that definitely put gas in the tank there. Drones are still such a hot-button issue with the FAA, and I understand that Disney is, particularly Walt Disney World, with the whole Reedy Creek Improvement District, and it still has to work hand-in-hand with government agencies. But mm-hmm. Disney has... certainly in Florida, a lot more sway, so to speak, in this situation. Yeah. I mean, Anaheim would be a very, very different conversation.
One of the flight plans was actually for Disneyland. It was over what's left of Rivers of America, right?
Yeah. But same thing. How many times have folks been out west to see a show of whether it's World of Color or Fantasmic, and the marine layer shifts?
Yeah, the wind changes direction in the middle of the show.
Yeah.
And you were dry and now you're wet.
Yes, that's exactly. Yeah, so yeah. I'm encouraged, I'm hopeful that they're filing this paperwork and they're looking, that this genuinely suggests that they've moved from the theoretical, the test phase to let's try this. But look, but.
They're on to me, Jim, I gotta go.
I just want to remind you folks that Disney did pretty much the same thing with the dragon that flew over New Fantasyland for one night.
I went to the bathroom and missed it.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story.
No, I had, that was the night I was there and I had food poisoning. I mean, Nancy, Angela, and our friend Flo had a wonderful time and saw it. And same thing. You were probably one stall over for me, Len.
Anyway. So we'll pick up with Splash Mountain on the next chronological Disneyland, right?
That we will.
Fantastic. All right, you've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. We are produced fabulously, I might add, by Aaron Adams. Please go onto iTunes and Stitcher and rate our show and tell us what you would like to hear next. Quick update on that. Jim and I are heading out to Walt Disney World at the end of January to record some live shows, so get those show topics into us as soon as possible, please. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care, guys.